Ajahn Brahm was born in London and graduated with a degree in theoretical physics from Cambridge University. After teaching in a high school for 1 year, he traveled to Thailand to become a Theravada Buddhist monk under the guidance of the late meditation master Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Brahm has now been a Buddhist monk for over 40 years. Currently, he is the abbot of Bodhayana Monastery and also the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, among many other roles. He is a highly sought-after speaker, having been invited to give talks at the United Nations as well as the corporate headquarters of Facebook and Google. He is also the author of many international bestsellers, including Good, Bad, Who Knows, Mindfulness, Bliss, and Beyond, The Art of Disappearing, and also Opening the Door of Your Heart. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Ajahn Brahm by giving him a round of applause.
Thank you.
Whoa!
Thank you. And first of all, I would repeat that piece of information for those of you who come in late. Make sure that your mobile phones and devices are turned off, because if your mobile phone goes off during the talk, because I'm a Buddhist monk, it means your mobile phone makes bad karma. And in its next life, it will be reborn as a parking meter, which is the lowest form of life for technology. So out of compassion for your iPhone, please turn it off. Imagine what would happen if, when the Buddha was getting enlightened, his iPhone went off. It would have disturbed him. So we are kind and considerate to ourselves and to others. And most importantly, today it's all about learning how to be happy no matter what happens in our life. And to me, that was the most important thing about having a spirituality. I never wanted a spirituality which was miserable. I wanted something which would make me happy. And that was one of the reasons in my life why I actually chose to go to Thailand to become a Buddhist monk. Reason was that I was in London, I saw monks from all different countries, and the ones which were the happiest were the ones I saw from Thailand. That's why I went there, because I wanted to see someone who was living a life which made them happy. And even right now, you've all come here spending your evening listening to a talk, and the last thing you need is to be bored. So when I give a talk, I make sure that people enjoy the talk and it's not boring. Because I remember when I went to church, it was just so scary. When I went to even a Buddhist temple, it was so boring. It wasn't really relative to real life. And even for those people who are out and out Buddhists, what did the Buddha teach anyway? Just the Four Noble Truths. You know what the Four Noble Truths are? Happiness, the cause of happiness. Why sometimes we're unhappy and the unhappiness exists. To me, they are the basic teachings of Buddhism, no matter what type of Buddhism, actually the basic teachings of life. Put aside all religions, the basic teachings of life. How we can bring happiness into our life no matter what we are doing in our life. And it is possible. And I am going to teach about how it can be possible in all areas of our life. And of course, these days, it's not just giving talks to corporations, it's also giving talks in medical facilities. So how you can be happy even when you are sick. That is amazing to see, that even though you are sick, you don't need to let that stop you happy, being happy and smiling. And in fact, I remember just going to one of my disciples in hospital because she just had a hysterectomy. And you know, that's a terrible thing for a woman because, you know, psychologically, losing her ability to have children in the future. And it's also quite painful. So she wanted some counseling. And as soon as I came in the room, the first thing she said was, "Ajahn Brahm, please don't tell any jokes." Because laughing makes it hurt so much. She had a big scar in her chest. But I said, "Well, you shouldn't invite me because I can't do anything else except to laugh at life." Because humour, when it's done right, when it's done well, not only does it teach you something about life, but it also, you know, creates these endorphins in the bloodstream, which is nature's immune suppressant, and which immune enhancer, pain suppressant. The laughter does add a lot of happiness in life. And even when not just going to hospitals, you know, counseling people when they have a funeral, sometimes that, why does it have to be so depressing? And in fact, I think I was probably the first person in the world to tell a joke at a funeral service. And I remember this so clearly, that when the funeral director realized I was telling a joke, he was sitting in the back in his black suit, looking really miserable, because they must be trained to look miserable, funeral directors. And he was saying, "No, no, no." But I would never let him stop me. So this was actually the story I told. And this is really important. Not only is it funny, but it tells you how you can be happy even though somebody dies. So there was this couple. The first of all, the guy, who's really old, he died. And a few days later, his wife passed away too. They lived such a long time together. I've seen it so many times. When one dies, the other one dies as well. They're almost like emotionally and even physically entangled. And so when one goes, the other one loses the will to live. And so they both died pretty much together. And so they appeared in heaven together. And when they were met by this angel, the angel said, "Because of your great good karma, because of all your goodness in your life, I've come to show you your heavenly reward." And they took them to this incredible mansion overlooking the ocean. And he said, "This is your heavenly reward for all of your good karma." And the guy said, "Look, I'm on a low salary. There's no way I can afford the council rates, the land tax on such an expensive property." You know, you have to pay, the bigger your house, the more you have to pay to the government. That's the same in Hong Kong. He said, "Can't we get something smaller and affordable?" And the angel said, "Sir, this is heaven. We don't have any tax in heaven. We don't have any government. So it's free." And then the angel took them inside the mansion. And there were so many rooms, and the furnishings were incredible. They had these chandeliers with diamonds, not cut glass, dripping from them. They had these huge plasma screen TVs, 100-foot wide. And he said, "I know you used to like the EPL soccer and used to support Liverpool. On this TV, your soccer team always wins." It's heaven. And even the toilet, he took them in the toilet. The toilet bowl was made of solid gold. And again, the little button you press at the top, you know, was a diamond. And when you pressed it, not water came out, but Chanel number 5. This was heaven. He said straight away, "Look, There's some really expensive furnishings in this house. I wouldn't be able to afford insurance premium. What are you talking about, insurance? There are no thieves up in heaven. You don't need insurance. It's all for free. Enjoy. And then he took him into the garage. Triple garage. And the first car was this stretch limousine. It was so huge, they had a tennis court inside. The next car was one of these four-wheel drives, all-terrain vehicles. He said, this car can go anywhere. It can go in the desert, in the mountains. It's even so powerful. It can go up waterfalls. I've never seen that before, but this is heaven. And the third car was a Ferrari. A limited edition, super duper Ferrari, red with a sunroof. And the angel said, sir, I always knew you loved fast cars. But in this life, what's the point of getting a Ferrari in Hong Kong? There's too much traffic. It was quite an achievement to get here on time today, going through the harbour tunnel. But that's what the man said. He said, what's the point of fast cars? If it's not traffic, it's policemen with their speed camera guns. I'll get fined. What's the point? And the angel said, sir, there are no policemen up in heaven. You don't get fined. You can go as fast as you like. Because if you have a crash, it doesn't matter. You're already dead. And then they opened the garage doors, and opposite his house was this immaculate 18-hole golf course with this beautiful clubhouse just on the other side of the road. And the angel said, we knew also how you love playing golf. So we arranged a golf course right next to your house. But he said, this golf course is special. It was designed by no other than Tiger Woods. And he said, but how could that happen? Tiger Woods is still alive. He said, but don't you remember when he had that argument with his wife and he crashed the car, he had a near-death experience. And when he was out of his body, we got him to design the golf course. Then we sent him back again. But this is designed by, and this is heavenly golf course. So once you get it on the green, whichever way you putt it, it always curls into the hole. And he said, but look at that clubhouse. Someone of my social status would never get elected to be a member, let alone be able to afford the annual fees for such an elite golf club. And the angel rolled his eyes and said, sir, you're already a member. For free, not a life member, a death member. And at that, the angel left him to his beautiful mansion with 100-foot-wide TV screen where his football team always won. Great Ferrari in the garage and also the golf course across the road. And as soon as the angel left, the husband started getting really angry at his wife. Scolding her, shouting at her, saying terrible things about her. And she could not understand why. So when he paused to take a breath, she said, why are you so angry at me? You've got this beautiful house. You can watch your soccer team win every time. You got your Ferrari. You can go as fast as you like and your golf course on the opposite side of the road. Why are you so angry? And he looked at her. Because, wife. Because, wife, if it wasn't for all that healthy food you gave me, I could have been up here years ago. So cut out the healthy food, okay? There's a golf course and a Ferrari waiting for you. So I like that story. It's not just a joke. Of course, you know, I add a few things to make it interesting, but why are we afraid of death? So you can be happy dying. If it was me and a doctor came up and said, Ajahn Brahm, I'm terribly sorry to tell you, you've only got a month to live. I would look at him and said, can't you make it 2 weeks? 1 week? So this is taking stuff in our life which, because we don't understand, causes us suffering and stops our happiness. I want to change that all around and make it happy. Even things like, you know, just death or losing a loved one. And this is my story about how to deal with grief. And this is, again, a story from my own life. When I was 16, my father died. I was a young man. Young men need those male role models. And I had a very good father. And I wasn't sad. I never cried when he died, nor did I cry afterwards, nor have I ever cried at my father's death. And that was weird. How can you love someone so much and not cry? And the answer came to me when I became a monk. As a monk, you have more time. More time to contemplate, to meditate, and to understand especially your emotions. And I realized the emotion I felt when my father passed away at his funeral and ever since was exactly the same as the emotion I felt many times at the end of a concert. Musical concert. This hall reminds me of many of the places I used to go as a young man to listen to great music. Classical music, jazz music, rock music. And some of those concerts, when it get to the end of the concert, all in the audience, including me, we would stand up, clap, and shout for more. It was called the encore. My father did many encores, came very close to dying several times, but was resuscitated. He did about 2 or 3 encores. But then came the time, as in a musical performance, when it was his last encore, he died. And I remember those times at the end of a great concert. Remember, growing up in London, you saw so many amazing musicians. I always like to tell the story about my brother and I going to a pub in the north of London where a band was playing, and only 6 people turned up to listen to this band. My brother and I were 2 of those 6. These days, you'd be lucky to get a seat in the back of a huge stadium because the lead singer was Rod Stewart. In the early days, personal concert by Sir Rod. But I remember after all those great performances, you know, after the encore, I would walk out of that auditorium, that club or that pub, into the cold, wet London night. It was dark and gloomy. But I never once felt sad at the end of a great concert. The emotion I felt was one of gratitude, privilege. How lucky I had been to listen to some of the greatest performers, some of the best music the world could offer. And that emotion, which I think you have shared as well, many times you've seen a great performance in an auditorium like this, and you've gone out, not sad, but you feel like you've been blessed. And that's exactly how I felt when my father died, his cremation. And I walked out of that crematorium in West London, Mortlake Crematorium. I didn't feel sad. I felt blessed. Thank you, Dad. 16 years. It's not enough. Loved more. But thank you for those 16 years. I never grieved what was lost. I celebrated what I'd gained. what I'd had. Amazing time with an amazing man. Thank you, Father. And just like those, that music which I'd heard, I've been a monk over 42 years now. This is my 43rd year. And I still remember that music over 50 years ago. And I still remember my father, those beautiful times we shared together. It never leaves you. So it becomes a different way to look at what causes a lot of suffering to people. You don't grieve a death. You say, thank you for that life. Thank you for being there and being part of your life. It changes suffering to something far more beautiful, like the same feeling at the end of a great concert. You know, sometimes, unfortunately, it's a young child who dies. And sometimes you can accept, you know, and middle-aged, elderly people who died. But when it's somebody who's very young, that causes so much suffering for people. And of course, the main suffering is, why? Why did a young child, only 2 or 3 years of age, 5 years of age, they haven't had a chance to live a life yet? Why do those things happen? And for me, the answer was in this other simile, which was told to me by an old monk who lived in the north of Thailand. It's amazing that, you know, when you get away from society and have a little bit of a retreat and solitude, it's amazing how much you can understand just by observing nature. Because he was staying in a small bamboo hut with rushes, straw for the roof, in the middle of a forest. And one night there was a storm, a particularly heavy storm, so bad that trees started to become uprooted and came crashing down on the ground. When I give a talk, I always like to raise my voice, crashing down on the ground, because some people go asleep when they listen to talks, and this is my method of waking them up. Crashing down on the ground. And he was awake all night, because if one of those trees, even if a heavy branch, would hit his roof, it was just straw. It would go straight through. And if it didn't kill him, it would injure him, which would be worse. No iPhones, no one to call. You're stuck in the middle of the jungle, no, injured with no way out. So he was quite scared all night. But he obviously survived, which is why he could tell the story. And in the morning, when it was light, he went out to see the damage. And many trees had just missed his little hut. But it wasn't the trees and the branches which took his attention. It was the leaves on the forest floor. Because most of the dead leaves, which had been stripped from the trees the night before, most of the dead leaves were the old brown leaves. But amongst many of those brown leaves were many yellow leaves, even a few green leaves. And he noticed a few fresh, young, green leaves among the dead brown ones. They had probably only shot forth the day before, and they too lay dead on the ground. And then he looked up to see what leaves were left up on those trees. Mostly they were green leaves, but even though young green leaves lay dead on the floor, there were still a few old brown curly leaves still clinging on. And he realized that is the nature when a strong wind blows through the forest. It takes mostly the old leaves, but it always takes the middle-aged leaves, young leaves and baby leaves as well, while it still leaves some old, curly, old people clinging on to life, even though young people die. Has anything gone wrong? No, this is the nature of storms. When the storms of sickness go through our communities and families, they do mostly take the old ones. They also take some young ones as well. leaving your old grandparents, your old Kong Kong, still alive after so many years. Nothing's gone wrong. That takes away a lot of the suffering of not understanding the answer to the question why. So one of the other areas, because I wanted a spiritual path, which was actually reasonable and you could use. And one of the other parts of suffering, I don't just do funerals, but I also do marriages as well. And I make sure whenever I do a marriage blessing or ceremony, I make sure I give that everything I've got. Not because I'm a kind monk, it's because I'm a selfish monk. Because I know those people I marry, if they have any problems or difficulties, they will come and bother me. I like an easy life, I'm busy enough. So you get it right to begin with, and then they are happy. So, many of you have partners, your partners might be here today, and you know it's not an easy thing to be married, to live with another person and have some peace and harmony. So there's a couple of key stories which I tell at every marriage. In fact, I did a marriage ceremony just before I came here on a Saturday, I came here on a Monday, and this couple, they really appreciated this. They're an Indonesian couple. And the story was one of my favorites about the chicken and the duck. A young couple had just been married, and they were walking in the park one afternoon when they heard this sound, quack, quack. Quack, quack. And the woman, the wife, said, "Oh, darling, can you hear that? That's a chicken." He said, "Pardon? It's a chicken. Didn't you hear it?" And he said, "It went quack, quack. It's a duck." He said, "No, no, I'm certain that's a chicken." He said, "It can't be. It's a duck." And it went quack, quack again. "There you are. It's a duck." She said, "No, I am sure it is a chicken." He said, "No, it's a duck." She said, "It's a chicken." He said, "It's a duck." She said, "But it's a chicken." He said, "It's a duck. D-U-C-K, duck." And then she started to cry. "It's a chicken." And then he suddenly remembered why he married her. He squeezed her hand gently, looked into her wet eyes, and said, "Darling, I think you may be right. It is a chicken." And she said, "Thank you, darling, thank you." And they carried on their walk happily, without any argument, and that evening he got a hot dinner. And the explanation to that really important story is this. Who cares whether it's a chicken or a duck? Is that worth having a divorce over? And honestly, most marital problems are over chickens and ducks. Stupid things. So look, guys, if you want a happy marriage, if she says, and it goes quack, quack, if she says it's a cow, agree with her. "Yeah, it's a cow, darling." And number two, how many times you think you're right and it turns out you're wrong? It happens to me many, many times. So just because it goes quack, quack, does not mean it's a duck. It could actually be a chicken. A chicken from Fukushima nuclear disaster zone, genetically mutated by the radiation to go quack, quack. Yeah, she could be right. And it's the same if he says it's a mouse or something. Please agree with him. On small things, it's not important. Because it's all about priorities. Happiness is all about knowing what's the important thing. And in a marriage, it's not being right. That's not important at all. What's important is being in love and harmony and being an example to others how two people can live together at peace. And the second thing which I tell in a marriage, which I love telling, is I usually look at the bride first of all. I did this on Saturday and it's great. They didn't get it at first, but they got it in the end. I look at the bride straight into her eyes and say, "You're a married woman now. From today on, you must never think of yourself." And she gets it. She understands. She said, "Yeah." And then I look at the man, the groom. Say the same thing to him. "You're a married man now. You mustn't think of yourself." Now, I do most of the marriages in Australia, Australian guys. When I say that to him, "You mustn't think of himself," he usually pauses first of all. But he eventually agrees. It's men, especially in Australia. But still looking at the guy, I tell him, "And from this day on, you're married. You must never think of your wife." And then I look at her and said, "Same with you. From this day on, you must never think of him, your husband." You've gone quiet now. Just like every couple. What on earth does this mean? When you tell stories like this, which confuses people, people pay attention. They want to find out what the answer is. And when you know the answer, oh yeah. The answer is, when you're married, you must never think of yourself, nor must you think of your partner. You must only think of us. You're in it together. It's us, not him, not me, not her, but us. This is one of the biggest mistakes in a marriage, which causes a lot of suffering and stops you being happy. It's always either sacrificing yourself for your partner or being selfish. Both are wrong. If you sacrifice for your guy, for your woman, you get burnt out. There's nothing in it for you anymore. If you're selfish, it's not a marriage at all. So in a marriage, it's all about us. So if there's a problem in your marriage, whose problem is it? Ours. You're in it together, you fix it together. And quite honestly, there's no problem you can't fix if it's together. If you say it's his fault, it's her fault, it's my fault, then you're dead. If it's our fault, then fix it up together. That's why I have so much success. Divorce lawyers hate me. I'm really bad for business. So that's how you can be happy in a marriage. Yeah, I told a long time ago, I told it again here somewhere, the three rings of marriage. You know the three rings of marriage? This is in my old book. The three rings of marriage are the engagement ring, number one. Second ring is the wedding ring, number two. And the third ring is the suffer ring. But that's being very negative. I don't know why you laugh at it. There must be some truth in it. But I'll change that now. The first ring of marriage is the sharing. The share ring. And the second ring of marriage is the care ring. And the last ring of marriage, the offer ring. You give yourself to the marriage. Okay? Sharing, caring, offer ring. The three rings of marriage. But you know that sometimes that I've seen no one shouts as much at each other as a man and his wife. Don't know why that is. Why do you have to shout? And this one monk once told me this. I don't know where he got it from, but I like sharing it. You know the reason why you shout at each other is because you become distant. Not physically distant, but emotionally distant, which is why we need to shout. When you're loving one another, when you really are close, that's when you just whisper, "I love you, darling." Have you ever noticed that? when you have a beautiful relationship together, you don't need to shout because you are close. A whisper can be heard, can be heard. But when you are apart, you start to shout. So for goodness sake, come close together. You don't need to shout. They can hear you very well. And it shows you just how you can take one of the great institutions of our world, a marriage, and also turn it into a place where you can be happy every day in a marriage. Isn't that wonderful? Remember those two stories, chickens and ducks, and it's about us. So, but then you go and have kids. When you have kids, it's amazing just how crazy people are. You know, they're already finding it difficult living with one guy, and now you've got another one, and another one, and another one. Ooh. But if you do have children, especially in Hong Kong, please treat them kindly. Stop pushing them. I said this in an interview this afternoon. This is fact. Half the children in Hong Kong, half of them are below average intelligence. That's obvious, isn't it? That's what average means. Half of them have to be below average intelligence. But you all think, oh, but not my kid. Oh, give them a break. Look, I was a school teacher for 1 year, high school, teenagers. You know, that's one of the reasons I became a monk. If you're teaching kids all day, they drive you crazy. I'd already torn my hair out, so I might as well go the rest and become a monk. But no, I had fun. It wasn't because I was running away from something. I just liked the happiness of, you know, this particular lifestyle. But at the end of the year, you know, I had to give out the report cards, you know, for my class. And of course, it's a class of, I think, 30, could have been 31, I can't remember now. One of my children came bottom of the class, 30th, out of a class of 30. Now, even if they were all Einsteins, someone had to come 30th. Just because you come 30th doesn't mean you're dumb. But this kid thought he was stupid. And I saw him open up his report card and his jaw drop and his shoulders hunch. Depression. The first step to suicide. Now, that's going a bit too far, but, you know, he was really, really upset. And he could read his mind. He didn't need to have psychic powers. He was thinking, oh, crikey, what am I going to do when my parents find this out? They're going to scold me, stop me doing this, stop me doing that, and all my friends will call me dummy, stupid. He was so upset. And I'm a kind man, compassion. I was a Buddhist. They all knew I was a Buddhist. Anybody, no matter what religion, aren't we supposed to be kind to one another? And you see somebody suffering in your class. I have a duty of care. I've got to look after him. So I went up to him and said, you come bottom of class. Yes, sir. Congratulations, I said. And I said, all the rest of your friends in this class are so selfish. You are the only compassionate person. You have taken this position in this class intentionally so none of your friends will have to suffer what you're going to get from your parents tonight. Everyone else just thinks of themselves. You think of others. In fact, I said, I'm going to nominate you to the headmaster, the principal, for the Bodhisattva of the Year award. Because Bodhisattvas in Buddhism, they sacrifice their happiness for others. That's what we're supposed to do. So he said, I'm a Buddhist, then you as a Buddhist, you are the only real religious person in this school. Sacrificing yourself for others. Well done. I'm going to go to the headmaster immediately and put in a recommendation. You get Bodhisattva prize. I remember his face looking at me as if I was crazy. But I just gave another perspective. So if your kid comes bottom of this class in school, congratulate them. Wow, I'm so proud of you, son. You are a real bodhisattva, thinking of other people, not thinking. You know, so I like turning things around like that. Sometimes you wonder, you know, why, you know, Hong Kong doesn't do well at soccer, or why other Buddhist countries never do well. You got like Thailand, they never go to the World Cup soccer. Burma, Sri Lanka. And there's a good reason why. You know why? Because if you play on a soccer team and you're a Buddhist, you have to follow Buddhist principles. The first one is let go. If the other team wants the ball, give it to them. Let go and don't be attached. Number two, if they can't score a goal, you score one for them, own goal. Compassion, kindness. Now you know there's too many Buddhists in the Hong Kong soccer team. That's why they never win. So you never win a game. You have a lot of fun, though. And isn't that the most important part of playing sport? Enjoying it, having fun. Happiness. You know, here in Hong Kong, the reason why you want your kids to do well, because you want them to be successful. But I'm saying this again. I wanted people to see things in a totally different way, so that where there was suffering, now you can have happiness. The secret of happiness is not striving. The secret of happiness is seeing things in a wise way. So happiness is there for you, anytime, any place, any situation. Just change the way you look at things. When I was young, I really thought you had to work hard, be successful, to be happy. This was almost like the story of my life. Growing up in UK, doing O-level exams. At that time, I loved playing soccer. I was out in the street playing football with my friends, you know, every spare opportunity, until my parents and my friends told me, don't spend too much time chasing a ball. Go and do your homework, extra studies, because if you pass your O-levels, then you'll be happy, you'll do well. And I believed them. So I really worked hard, and I passed my O-levels, did really well. You know what happened? Was I happy? No, more exams, A-levels. But I still believed them, and they said, at that time I wasn't chasing footballs, I was chasing girls. They said, stop chasing girls, stay at home, don't go to so many parties, dances and stuff, that was those days, and do your homework. And if you get your A-levels, good marks, you go to good university, then you'll be happy. Believed them again, so I did really well and went to a good university. More exams. Was I happy? No, but they said, don't worry about it. Sacrifice a little bit more, because after 3 years, if you get a degree, a good degree from a university like Cambridge, then you're made, you'll be happy. I looked at other people who had got their degrees. Were they happy? Nope. Some of them were doing masters, some were doing, there's still more exams. This is the rule of our world. If you pass an exam, you've got another one to take next. There's no end to them. So I tell kids these days, don't worry, if you fail an exam, you're out. Otherwise, you have to do another one next year. You keep on going until you eventually fail, so get it over and done with early in your life, then you're free. Parents hate me for that. But then, okay, so there you were. I started to get doubtful about all this. Get a degree, achieve something, then you'll be happy. Because I saw other people who had got their degrees. Were they happy? No. Then they were working really hard, saving money to get their first little apartment or get a car. And then working really, really hard. And then before they could pay off, you know, their car or get a deposit for an apartment, you fell in love. Because they thought, when I find my soulmate, when I find the one who's meant for me, then I'll be happy. They actually believe that. I thought people have been married for 2 or 3 years. There's something wrong here. How come you're not happy? So I decided to get Daphne. But I saw this is what happens. You know, you get married and then you have some happiness, but then you have a kid. It's really more hard work. But how many of you see people in the middle age, when my child completes their education and I set them up, they're nice and happy, then I'm free and I can go off and do whatever I want in this world. You sacrifice so much for your kids. It's beautiful to see, but you always think, when my kids grow up and leave, then I'll be happy. But by that time, you're usually so old, you're looking for retirement. And then you think, when I retire, then I'll be happy. Are you happy when you retire? No. That's why many, many old people, you see them in churches and Buddhist temples. You know why many old people go to churches and Buddhist temples? Because they believe that when they die, then they'll be happy. It's always in the future somewhere. And I thought, there's something wrong with this. So that runs much of your life. When you complete that project, when you get enough money to pay off your mortgage for expensive homes, when I get this problem solved, this thing achieved, then I'll be happy. And you never get happy. So there's something wrong with that. Success, achievement does not lead to happiness. And then I found some psychologists who started saying, no, 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 happiness comes first. And then you become successful. So find something you're passionate about. Some career, it may not pay you well, but you really love doing it. It's who you are. And then success will follow. If you like designing clothes, then it's hard work at first, but you love doing it, therefore you'll be good at it, and then you'll be successful afterwards. That was also scam, not true. And then I suddenly realized in my monk life, it's not that success leads to happiness or that happiness leads to success. Happiness is success. So if you're happy right now, congratulations. You've made it. You're successful. If you're happy right now, you've arrived, baby. You've arrived. I love saying that. It's so 1960s. Anyway, so when we change the meaning of success to being happy, that changes a lot of how you look at your children. You want them to be successful? Understand what success is. Happiness. And you don't need much to be happy. Look at me. I've actually got no money, no bank account, no credit card, no superannuation investments. Oh, absolutely nothing. How do I survive? Very well, thank you. No, my investment. I often tell people this, don't have any health insurance. What happens if I get sick? If I got sick in Hong Kong, I would have so many doctors, there's quite a few in front row here, so many doctors will be fighting other doctors. No, it's I want to look after him. No, it's my good karma. I will do it. No, 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 no. And I will get the best treatment for free. Why is that? Because my investment was in kindness and service. Helping others, serving others, and it comes back to you. I heard this story when I was in San Francisco a couple of years ago. There was a gentleman, he was in his car in a remote part of California, and his car broke down, and he didn't know how to fix it, and there was no signal to call anyone on his iPhone. So he was stuck there. But it's similar in Australia, an advanced country, but so big, there's many areas which will never, ever have coverage. So he's waiting and waiting and waiting, and you know, in those remote parts of the world, you know, anyone passes will always stop and help. So a farmer stopped to help this gentleman. And if you live in a farm, even in a monastery, you develop all sorts of skills. So, you know, simple skills, you can fix up small problems. And this farmer was able to fix up the problem in the car. So the gentleman shook his hand, thank you so much, and drove off. About 2 weeks later, this farmer received a letter from his bank. His mortgage and all his debts had been paid off, and a lot of money had been deposited in his check account because the guy whose car had broken down was Bill Gates. Apparently, true story. So please remember that. If anybody's car has broken down, please stop. You don't know who it could be. Lee Cushing. Because, you know, a lot of these very wealthy people, they just, you know, they want a bit of freedom. They don't want to be chauffeured around all the time. I know that Brad Pitt, apparently, he likes driving himself around because it's the only time he feels free. You know, if he's in his going anywhere, he's recognized and photographed and all sorts of stuff. So he likes driving in his car alone. Sense of freedom, independence, he's like normal. So if ever you see a car broke down by the side of the road, who knows, that could be Brad Pitt. And apparently he's free now because he's separated from Angelina Jolie. There's your chance. But it's just kindness and service. It always comes with this basic law of karma. It always works. Just a little bit of kindness causes a lot of happiness. And I said this afternoon, I'm going to tell this story. You know, sometimes, you know, we're always giving Muslims a bad name. This is a beautiful Muslim story. True, happened in Indonesia. And this, the reason I tell this is because there was, we're talking about the story in Les Miserables and the penal system in our modern world. Those of you who know Les Miserables, the story by Victor Hugo, Jean Valjean, you know, he stole a loaf of bread. Why? Because his family were hungry. And honestly, that sometimes I think if I was in that situation, I had a wife and kids, that's what I would do as well. But in that situation, he was put in terrible jail for such a long time. But this happened last year in Java. There was a woman whose husband had run away, looking after two children by herself, stole a breadfruit from the market. Stole it, was caught, and the owner of the market store prosecuted her. So she had to go before the judge in the court of law. And the judge said, well, did you steal it? She said, yes, I did. And then, why? She said, because my husband disappeared about a year ago. I don't know where he's gone. But, you know, I can't feed my family. They're hungry, my kids. And the judge looked at the owner of the store and said, can you forgive her? Can you let it go? The poor lady is hungry and her kids. But according to the law in Indonesia, based on Islamic law, it's up to the offended person to forgive or not. And he said, no, prosecute her. So the judge had no choice. Said, you're guilty, so I'll fine you 1 million rupiah, which is about $100. Maybe not much for you, but for this poor girl in Java, she hung her head, started weeping. There's no way she could pay that money. If she had $100, she wouldn't need to steal a breadfruit. And then the judge continued, but he said, I am also going to fine everybody in this courtroom. I find you guilty for allowing such poverty to exist in our city. You are all fined 100,000 rupiah each, including me. And he passed his judicial hat around, put 100,000 in, and when it went round everybody in that courtroom, they collected 5 million rupiah. He took out 1 million rupiah to pay the fine, and the other 4 million he gave to the poor woman. He said, it's our fault that you had to steal. Here is 4 million, $400, that should keep you going for a long time. And I thought, that's wonderful justice. It happened. Those are things which inspire us. And in cases like that, it creates happiness. We're thinking outside the box, having a problem in our life and seeing it in a different way so that we can create more happiness in our world. And as far as your kids are concerned, again, if they're happy, they're successful. Going to a top school, going to university, doesn't make them happy. It's other stuff. Having time with their family. Hong Kong, how busy are you? This is the last story, because Gerald has got up there, it means I've got to stop soon. I remember telling this to a Muslim girl in the Salibs. Forget what the town was. She was interviewing me, and I told this story, and she wept and wept and wept. It hit her really, really deeply, because she was a single mum, had a kid, was working so hard, trying to get her kid to have a good life, sacrificing herself. And I said, this is a story of a child, 6 years of age, who was waiting for his father to come home from work. And this was in, I think, United States. And when his father came home from work, his six-year-old said, Daddy, how much do you earn at work? And the father had just come back home late, having a busy day. Look, it's none of your business, I'm tired. But Daddy, how much do you earn per hour at work? Look, I've told you, I'm tired, it's none of your business. But Daddy, how many dollars do you earn? That's it. 3 times I've told you, no, go to your room, you're grounded. So the poor six-year-old went up to his bedroom, only because the father was tired. After he had a cup of coffee and relaxed, he realized he'd been too harsh on his own son. So he went up to his son's room, let himself in, and said, Son, I'm sorry. I don't know why a six-year-old wants to know how much I earn at work, but it's $20 an hour, $20 an hour. And the son smiled sweetly and said, Thank you, Daddy. And then he looked at his daddy and said, Now, Daddy, can I borrow $10, please? And his father was about to get angry at him again, but you get angry once a day, that's enough. So he bit his lip, took out his wallet, and took out a $10 note and gave it to his son. Thank you, Daddy. And then his son reached in the bedside drawer and took out some coins, counted out $20, gave it to his father with the words, Now, Daddy, can I have 1 hour of your time, please? It's the story of our modern world. What your children need is time with you. That's what makes them happy. They don't need to be told off and say, get to your room, do your homework. So the kid paid $20 to his dad to get 1 hour of his time. When I told that to this Muslim mother, she wept. She realized what her son really wanted was just time with his mummy. And she was working so hard, trying to get other things, what she thought her children wanted. Good education, good clothes. That's not what children want. They want time with you. Now you know how to get happy kids. I better stop now, otherwise I get in big trouble. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm, for giving us such an inspiring talk on how to live happily every day. Now, I'm going to open up the floor, and if any one of you would like to ask Ajahn Brahm questions, please raise your hand, and my colleagues will be passing the microphone to you. So Ajahn Brahm only comes to Hong Kong once a year, so please feel free to ask him any questions that you have. Over there, in the middle, at the back.
Come on, run faster, 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 faster. Train Olympic Games. There you go. Very good.
Thank you very much. It is very good to me have a good chance to ask you a question. This is a very good talk. I feel very enlightening.
Good.
First of all, I will sometimes talk about your grief. I think all the people are greedy. As you said, I want more.
Yeah.
And then I think it creates this the suffering.
Yeah.
So how can we tackle this problem?
Tackle this problem. This is an old saying, when you want something more, you cannot enjoy what you already have. And that's spirituality in a nutshell. So it's good that you work from Monday to Friday, but on the weekend, can't you just enjoy what you've already got? You got an apartment, you got maybe a beautiful wife, lovely kids. Enjoy them for who they are. If you want something more as a husband, you look for a mistress. And you don't appreciate what you already have. So a lot of times that people, because you don't see what you have already, look, even your apartment now in Hong Kong, 100 years ago, kings, wealthy people would kill for such comfort. You've got climate control. You've got a TV where you can have entertainment at any time of the day or night. Not even a king could do that. You go downstairs into the street, you can get every food in the world as much as you want. Even emperors couldn't eat like that. You've got beautiful health care. You can go anywhere in the world. It's amazing just what we have. Why do we want more? So sometimes you stop looking at what you haven't got and you look at what you have got. And that makes you so appreciative. You know, your wife, your partner, you may want them to be better, but look what they have got and appreciate that. It's the old two bad bricks in the wall story. Why is it that when, you know, I made my first brick wall, I made two mistakes, and that's all I ever saw for 3 months, my mistakes. We always see the faults in stuff. When you see the faults in a wall, you want to blow it up and destroy it and make another one. Once I saw the good bricks in the wall, the 998 good bricks, I could appreciate just how beautiful that was. You look at your partner, if you see all her faults, she's got them, many of them, but if you see the beauty in her, or the wonderful things which she's done for you, the really great qualities you share together, focus on that, what you have, rather than what you want. And you have so much contentment. Your kids may not be going to Harvard, but you can appreciate them and love them so much. You don't need to get them to be better. They're your kids. You love them. Love them for what they are. Sometimes people feel that that's no progress. That's a lot of progress. And also, if you love your kids and your partner for who they are, then your relationship grows and develops. And you feel how lucky I am with what I've got. Everything else is extra. So yeah, you go out to work, help the country, do your jobs, do your services. But take time to stop and appreciate how much you've already achieved. Similarly, I got many, 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 many responsibilities. Many people depend upon me. And I got so busy once running so many monasteries and looking after so many monks and nuns and lay people supporters, always on call whenever they needed me. And then I was at my monastery one day, taking somebody around, and they said, "This is such a beautiful monastery where you live. It's so peaceful, you're so lucky." And I said, "What? Don't you see all the things which are wrong with this monastery, all the gutters which need cleaning, the extra huts which need to be built, the roads which need to be swept, the monks which need to be taught how to meditate, all these telephone calls and emails?" And then I realized I was really going on the wrong path. The place where I lived was my work camp. Everyone else would visit and they thought it was peaceful and beautiful. So I decided to change my attitude. Now, one day a week, it's usually on a Monday morning, I pretend to be a visitor in the monastery where I live. So I can see it like you see it. So somebody asked me a question on meditation. Sorry, I'm not the abbot today, I'm only visiting. Something needs to be cleaned up. Sorry, I'm only visiting. A monk is causing problems. Sorry, I'm not the abbot today, I'm only visiting. And I advise you to do the same. In the apartment or home where you live, have one morning a week when you pretend to be a visitor, where you don't have to wash up the cups and dishes, you don't have to clean, no more than if you're visiting somebody else's home or apartment. Do you ever, when you're visiting a friend's apartment for dinner, do you wash up afterwards for them? Do you sort of vacuum the carpet for them? Fix the plumbing for them? It's not your job, you're a visitor. You're visiting this auditorium. How many of you are going to clean up afterwards? It's not your job, you're a visitor. That's why you can enjoy it. So for one day a week, or one morning a week, I'm a visitor to the place where I live, which means I've got no job and no duties. I can enjoy the peace and tranquility which everyone who's ever visited my monastery can also enjoy. Otherwise, if you're an owner, then you have responsibilities, then you can never have any peace. Don't always be an owner. In Buddhism, that's non-self, anatta, not me, not mine, not a self. Try it. Then you can enjoy it. Your partner, she's not yours. Then you can actually enjoy her much more. Your kids, not your kids, they're visiting you. No responsibility. Then you can have fun with them. It's an interesting perspective. If you're an owner, you've got responsibility. You've got to discipline your kids, force them to do their homework. But you know, your grandkids, grandchildren and grandparents get on so well together. You know, I remember my grandma, oh, she used to spoil me. And I was in England. Any time of the day or night, morning, afternoon, I could go to her little flat apartment and she'd give me chips. She'd cut up a potato and fry some chips for me. My mother would give her hell. You can't feed my child, you know, chips, it will spoil his dinner. But my grandma would say, if my grandson wants chips, he gets chips and that's it. She had no responsibility for me. So she loved me to bits, and I love my grandma. Now, why can't parents be like that? Maybe one morning a week. So responsibility is good, but when you have responsibility day and night, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, you miss out on life. Okay. Yeah, go on.
Okay, the lady on my right, left-hand side.
Hi, dear. I want to ask you this question about cross-generation, too. I noticed that with my age generation and above, we tend to have a very strong anchorage in ethics and values. Like you mentioned a lot about this duty to care for other people. Whereas in my observation, you know, chatting with other my colleagues or peers, and they noticed that with the younger generations and Dang, they don't have such a strong anchorage in values. First of all, I want to ask you if you share this observation. And second is my observation with my peers and colleagues is that exposing the younger generation too early to the electronic media, it kind of titrates or diffuses what they learned value-wise from their families. So do you see this trend kind of a bit not a good phenomenon or like going downhill a bit? What is your view on it?
My view is based on a quote from Socrates 2,500 years ago, who said almost exactly what you said. Children in Athens today have got no sense of responsibilities. You're saying it's timeless. Every generation, when you get to that age, says the same thing about the youth, and the youth become you, 30 or 40, and they say the same thing about their grandchildren. It's timeless. So it's nothing about our modern times. It's just about children growing up. And they're all like that, every generation. You were probably like that as well. You won't admit it, but you probably were. So we learn ethics and responsibilities. We're not taught it. Whatever you're taught is so external. You need to understand it. A good example is like speed cameras. In Australia, many speed cameras, and all they teach you is to know where the speed cameras are, how to avoid being caught. Taxis? How many of you pay your taxes honestly? Or how many times you find out a way of not sort of paying them? Find out to work the system rather than understanding the reason behind these things. So with morality, ethics, it's all about understanding why. And kids, as all the time, if they can understand why, you know, you shouldn't take alcohol. Why, you know, you shouldn't take drugs. Say it's wrong, it's bad, that makes it more attractive. Say why, and you understand it. That means so much more. You know, with drug education, that in one of our local schools, primary school, there's drugs in primary schools as well, that the head teacher wanted to do something to help the kids. But she did think outside the box. Instead of getting a social worker, a psychologist, or a doctor who know the theory but haven't really understood why, she asked the local prison to send two criminals who were in prison for drug offences to go to the school. These were people who had been there, done it, and were suffering in jail. And I knew that because these were two of my students I used to teach in jail. And I don't know how that principal got away with that. If the newspapers had found out, she'd have been crucified in the newspapers, allowing drug addicts to teach our kids. But those two went there, and I know that people who really knew what they were talking about, what drugs was like, personal experiences, they would be able to impart to those 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds much, much more than any professor, psychologist, doctor, or social worker could ever do. And then I saw all the letters which the school children had written to these two prisoners. And they wept, and these guys, they were crying, "Dear Nick, hope you get out soon. Thank you, we'll never take drugs." Oh, that meant so much to the people who had harmed themselves and harmed others. They'd done something beautiful and well. That is how we impart values to kids. We've got to actually think outside the box, as they say, and go really to the heart of things. The best people to teach about sort of the problems with drugs is those who've been there, suffered. Then it becomes what we call authentic. Most kids will rebel because what you're telling them is not authentic. You're telling us not to misbehave, not to take drugs, but you're taking alcohol, Mum, Dad. Kids see through that so easily. You've got to be authentic. But kids find their way. They are very resilient. I got a lot of faith in kids. My father used to say that I listened to Jimi Hendrix too much. And I used to listen to Jimi Hendrix doing my math homework. But I'd always come top of the class. So I said, oh, look, I can't understand this, but, you know, carry on listening because it's working. I don't know how. So many of the kids will be fine. So, yeah, they play computer games, but they succeed in the end. So I've got a lot of faith in kids, our youth, because I saw my friends. And they were doing similar things, playing too much time playing soccer in the streets or whatever else they were up to. But the kids will find values. Sometimes they discover them the hard way, but they'll discover them. And again, read Socrates, how he complained about youth today, 2,500 years ago.
Okay, the gentleman on my right-hand side at the back, please.
Oh, thank you for visiting us in Hong Kong. In the wake of what happened yesterday in London with the terror attack, if you have met a person who's going to tell you, I'm going to do some really nasty thing in public places and some people will suffer, what will you say to him to tell him not to do it? And what sort of treatment will you give it to him so that he will live happily every day?
Yep. Well, first of all, when I saw that news, I thought, my family lived through the Blitz in London during the Second World War. We're not four people dying. 400, 4,000 people were dying every night. And I saw I remember seeing as a young man, what they call bomb sites, places where huge explosions had happened. And many people just embraced that reality. And they went about their life not being affected by bombs. I remember one friend said that, you know, he was from New Zealand in the army visiting London. And the first day that there was an air raid siren, he ran for the cover of the tube station when he realized all the Londoners were moving in the opposite direction. They were just standing by the bus stop, reading their newspapers while the bombs were falling. And he realized this incredible resilience of that London population. They had this idea of karma. If that bomb's got your name on it, you can't escape it. And so they actually lived life by the day. And they said people who survived, like my mother and my grandfather and grandmother, say what a wonderful time that was. They looked after one another, they trusted one another, and they were living by the day rather than having all these huge ideas for the future. So number one, terrorism is a beat up by the media and the government. Four people died. How many people died in road accidents in UK yesterday? We don't think about that. How many people died from drug overdoses, from cardiac arrest? We don't think about that. And as soon as we stop the overreaction to terrorist attacks, there'll be no reason for terrorists to do such things. If it doesn't get in the newspaper, why do it? So that's one of the reasons. We overreact, and for religious or political reasons, people exploit that overreaction to make a statement. So I think it should be downplayed, first of all. And as far as the person who is doing that is concerned, again, there is an emotional sickness. Andres Lee Breivik, or whatever his name was, you know, the one who killed how many people? It's about 100 children, 100 young people in Norway. He is not punished. In the Norwegian, the Nordic judicial system, penal system, they don't look at it as punishment when you go into a jail. Rehabilitation, looked upon as like a sickness, a social sickness, an illness. which somehow has to be contained, quarantined, and treated with kindness. Because if you kill one terrorist, they make them what they call martyrs, and other people, you create 3 or 4, 5, 6 other terrorists who want revenge. Treat it with kindness, compassion, quarantine. If that person was captured, yeah, in a jail, but treated so kindly, to show the superiority of a modern justice system. You hurt them, kill them, and that feeds in to the cycle of revenge. That's why this beautiful non-violence is an important part of spirituality. So, if I met him, you know, and a person is about to kill, I'd probably kick him in the balls to stop him. And then, it wouldn't, you know, knock him out for a little while. And then do an order to stop him and then just call the police. But, you know, you wouldn't try and teach him the Dhamma. That's a stupid thing to do. But, you know, stop him in the most unlethal way possible. And then, you know, to try and be kind to him afterwards. Say, I'm terribly sorry, but you just had to do that, you know, just part of life. You can kick me in the balls because I don't need mine. I'm a monk. Okay, carry on.
Ray, please edit the part on kicking the balls, please. Any other questions? Anyone? Yes, the gentleman in the middle with a pair of glasses. Yes.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for tonight. Thank you for the time to think about the happiness. So just linking happiness with a lot of things that I've been going through recently, I feel like there's a lot of self-love or fear stroke, self-loathing that stops us from being happy. And I can't quite articulate the whole thing. I was just hoping if you can help me guide my thoughts or guide my heart towards how these different components work together.
Good,
thank you.
I understand your question because it's so common. People never think they're good enough. And you're taught you're not good enough. You're told that when you're at school. And I was a student. But my teacher said, you can always do better. And then always do better, try harder, get higher grades. There was no end to trying to do better. And if I felt inadequate, imagine how other kids felt who didn't sort of do so well at school. We're always taught we're not good enough. And then you know, you have a relationship. How many times does your boyfriend, your girlfriend sort of praise you, say, oh, thank you so much, you're so beautiful, you're such a great guy. They may do that in the beginning, but in the end, they start putting out your faults. Why did I marry you? Oh, jeez. And so we always feel we're not respected, that we're not understood, we're not loved. And that goes through our working career as well. Always having put-downs, criticism. And that we believe that to the point that our self-esteem is just way down bottom. And especially if you're a person in this world who's not a high flyer. And this was a story, again, told this afternoon, which is fresh in my mind in an interview, when I gave a lecture to the clients of the mental health service. These were people who had been through depression, suicidal, ODD, schizophrenia. These were the people who were being treated for these things, being traumatized at their youth. And I told them the simile of a forest. It's one of my best similes. If you don't think you're good enough, there's something wrong with you. If you think you are what they call these days damaged goods, go and have a walk in a natural forest and find a perfect tree, one which is straight with all the branches in the equally spaced, with only green leaves, no yellow leaves, no brown leaves, with no marks on the trunk. If you can find a tree like that, you'll be the first ever. Those trees do not exist in a forest. And in fact, if they did, they're not beautiful. When I walk in a forest, the trees I like the best, the ones which are most beautiful, are the crooked ones. They are bent by the storms, by the damage of their life so far. They've got many yellow leaves and brown leaves. Branches have been torn off, and in the holes left by those branches, that's where the birds make their nests, or in Australia, the possums. And the bark is all scarred by what they've had to endure, bushfires, other trees hitting them. And they got character. The most beautiful trees in a forest are those which have had the most damage. So I told these clients of the mental health services, if you are damaged goods, number one, you belong. You're part of the forest. You belong to the human species. Welcome. And number two, if you're really damaged, you are one of the most beautiful trees, the ones I love the most. And you hit people with this idea of rejection and stigmatizing, that you don't belong anymore, you're damaged, you're not beautiful, you're not gorgeous. Hit them so that they started crying. They realize, number one, you do belong, every and each one of you, no matter how ridiculous and stupid and wrong and all the mistakes you made in your life, you belong. And number one, number two, that I respect you, you're beautiful. And I really mean that. And at that, it's affirming who you are. And so once you stop trying to be something you're not, once you accept yourself, and not just accept yourself, value yourself, that's called kindness, compassion to yourself. And you find once you can do that to yourself, only then can you do it to others. Otherwise, the love you have for your partner, even your parents or your children, is not full. It's not. You always want your children to be something they're not. Your partner to be something they can never be. And you do that to yourself. Once you open the door of your heart to yourself, exactly as you are, not wanting yourself to be anything different, at peace with yourself, then you can know how to love others. I love myself. And that's why I can connect with so many other people. I can give you kindness. I learned it on myself first, so I can give it to others. And every and each one of you, one day, when you feel strong enough, in your own private moments, will say to yourself, me, this person I can never escape from, the door of my heart is fully open to me, with no conditions, with no demands I be anything else other than I am. I open the door of my heart to me. Come in, all of me, stupid part, idiotic part, and a good part as well. That's making peace with yourself. Once you know how to do that, you can love anybody. Even like prisoners, murderers, rapists, terrorists. Incredible what you can do. I've never met a terrorist yet, but people who have raped, murdered, many of those. Gorillas in human form. And when you see them and they know that you respect them, you have nothing to fear. They once told me, because there was a lot of rapes in this prison I was visiting, man-on-man rapes. This was a male prison and I was a man. And they said to me, Ajahn Brahm, do you think you could actually stop me from raping you? Huge, big guy. Nothing to lose. In jail for a long time. And I said, probably not. He said, no, I'm too fast. But he said, you've been so kind to us and respectful to us. You're one of the safest people in this prison. If anyone tried that, there'd be a dozen guys who would stop them. That was my protection. I'd given kindness. So I knew I was totally safe. That's how it works. When you know how to love yourself, other people just open up to you because you know how to love them as well. It's what my father taught me, how to open the door of my heart. When he said to me, son, wherever you go in your life, however you turn out, the door of my heart will always be open to you. You're my son. That's enough. I'll never reject you. You don't have to prove anything for my love. It's there. Forever. And that meant so much to me. And I hope you get that. You can look at your partner, doesn't matter how long you've been married, and say to your husband, look, whatever you do in your life, I'm your wife, I love you. The door of my heart will always be open to you, no matter what you do. And husband says to his wife the same thing, unconditional love. You've got to do it to yourself, first of all. Otherwise, it doesn't work. If you could do that, we wouldn't need psychologists. Probably half the doctors would be out of work. So, thank you for asking that question. Yeah, over there.
Ajahn, I'd like to seek your teachings about keeping the precepts. What happens if practicing doesn't make you happy? What happens when the five senses always wins and it's not getting hard to keep the self-discipline?
Okay, that means you're coming from the wrong place. So the precepts should never be coming from force. It should come from natural. It's called wisdom power, not willpower. A lot of times people want to be a good Buddhist, a good Christian, a good Muslim, and they just do it, trying to prove something, not understanding why. I mean, why should you kill anything? What have they ever done to you? Wait, before you swat a mosquito, ask a mosquito, do you want to die? Mosquito, you may not understand mosquito language, but I think you can pretty figure out that they don't want to die. So, why would you want to kill anything? Why would you want to steal? Somebody owns that, and they get so upset afterwards. You know, would you like your stuff disappearing? Why do we steal? And sometimes, like Jean Valjean, because you know he's got a good reason to steal, because to feed their family, but these days there's no necessity for that. And third noble truth, committing adultery. Mostly guys do that, but it takes two to tango. There's a woman involved there. So, why do you do that? One of the reasons is because you can think you can get away with it. Most men who commit adultery never think they will get caught. That is a delusion. General Petraeus, the head of the CIA at the time, was having an affair with his biographer. If the head of the CIA can't keep it secret from his wife, who can? So guys, if you're having an affair, you've got no chance. You're going to get busted. You're going to get busted for sure. And it's not worth it. Because once you get busted for having an affair, oh, it's just hell. It isn't worth it. And your kids lose all your respect for you. And you know, your poor partner, you know, a lot of times, the men who have affairs, they still love their wife in a weird way, this is men's psychology. Girls kind of get this, but they still love their wife, but they want to have a bit of fun. And they think they can get away with it. They think they're safe. But if you look, imagine what it's going to be like when you get caught. Then, whew, no way. And they're lying. Why do you want to lie for? Especially, this is lying. Why do people lie? Why do husbands lie to wives and wives to husbands? Why do your children lie to you? This is the reason why. I got this when this young girl, maybe 19 years of age, been coming to my temple, you know, ever since I, you know, she's probably in the womb, she came, and she grew up with me. So she looks at me as like almost like a godfather. She came to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, I need your help, I'm in big trouble. I'm pregnant with my boyfriend. So I told her, have you told your mum and dad yet? She said, no, that's my problem. Can you tell them for me? They'll kill me. And I was honored to be able to be of service to someone. She trusted me enough because she was Sri Lankan and I'm very highly regarded, you know, amongst Sri Lankan Buddhists. So I knew I could talk to her parents and get her off the hook and so calm her parents down. It happens, okay? You know. But what really worried me afterwards was why, when a daughter really needs her parents' help, was she terrified of telling them? Because telling the truth to the parents would get her scolded and get her, I don't know, punished or whatever. And I realized that punishment is what causes lying. When it's not in your interest to tell your husband what you've done, then you will lie. Because you get punished much more for telling the truth. When I saw that, I asked, and again, everyone I marry, to tell them, your husband and wife, please make a vow that whenever you, the husband, tells the truth to the wife, and the wife tells the truth to the husband, no matter what it is, no punishment, no scolding, no shouting, even though it might really disappoint you, your partner is telling the truth. Honor that. Make telling the truth more important than anything else. Amnesty. So that your partner never feels tempted to lie to you. It's not worth it. And say the same thing for your kids. Please let your kids know, as long as you tell us the truth, no matter what happens, you've been taking drugs, dealing in drugs, you tell your mum and dad, we will not scold you or punish you because we want to help you. That's what parents are there for. But if they're scared of you because you always punish them, then they will lie. Dad will kill me when he finds out I've been taking drugs. So they will lie and conceal it. When they need their father more than ever, they won't say. So instead of just saying, don't lie, why do people lie? Find the causes and solve those causes. Politicians, why do they lie? Because telling the truth means they won't get elected next time. If we're going to punish politicians, then of course they will lie. Everyone makes mistakes. Politicians make mistakes. Treasurers, prime ministers, presidents who make mistakes. Monks make mistakes. When I make a mistake, I tell everybody. That's why I have great fun. Saying, no, it's normal to make mistakes, which means that we don't need to lie. And the last thing, taking alcohol. Why do you want it? It costs a lot of money, and it also it's bad for your health. It's not fun. I remember this story, I was just saying it, about in Sydney some years ago, it was a Christmas, New Year's Eve party. So a guy was taking some alcohol, really getting into it in a party, and he had to get home. You should take a taxi if you've been drinking. But he thought, oh, what the heck? You know, the chances of getting caught are very, very small. So he drove his car home, even though he had lots of alcohol. Bad choice. because in that part of Sydney, the police had a roadblock testing every driver for their alcohol level. So what he knew once he got into the roadblock, he was caught, he was done. He'd probably lose his license and get a big fine. But when it came for his turn, the police asked him to get out of the car and they gave him the breathalyzer, the little tube he had to blow into. And he was holding that tube, but just before he blew in the tube, there was a sound of a car crash. One of the cars had been going a little bit too fast. It was a roadblock and had rear-ended the car in front of him. The policeman heard that and he took the tube away, said, "It's more important I deal with this traffic incident than check your alcohol level. Get in your car and go home." He literally became within a couple of seconds of getting caught. He thought he was so lucky that night. The following morning, he was woken up by someone banging on his door. He had a hangover. And when he went to the door, he found two Sydney policemen standing outside. First of all, he was scared. But then he thought, they can't prove that I was driving a car when I was drunk, because you know, it's finished now. So he said, "I'm safe." So he relaxed and the policeman asked, "Sir, would you mind if we look inside your garage?" He said, "Sure, I'm not a thief. I've only got my car in the garage, sure you can." So he opened up his garage, and when he opened up his garage door, he almost had a heart attack, because in his garage there was a police car. He'd been so drunk when they said, "Get in your car and drive home," he got in the wrong car and driven one of their cars home. They were missing a car and they had an extra car at the roadblock. They soon traced him. That's what happens when you break precepts. So when you know the wisdom of it, you say, "Well, why do I do these things?" You don't use willpower. Don't just because you're trying to show off, "I'm a Buddhist. I've got 5 precepts. You've only got 4 precepts. When you understand why, then it's so easy. Then wisdom, kindness wins. Okay, next question.
Okay, so one last question.
Over here, there's one over there.
So in the Buddhist tradition, there's the teaching of stream enterer and no returner. So it seems that to enter the state of nirvana, the cycle of birth and death has to be ceased so that we do not continue to reborn. And is it true that the will to continue to live must stop so that we can be liberated from all suffering? Thank you.
Okay, now that sounds a very deep question, but I'm going to start with a little story that many of you have been listening to my talks many times on the internet, on YouTube, read my books, and come to every talk I've given in Hong Kong. You do find that I repeat myself very often. Many of those stories you've heard before. Even the story about, you know, the police car being stolen. I've said that so many times, but usually the people who come to my talks getting old, so you've forgotten I told you that story. But it reminded me of a story which I told earlier, that Albert Einstein, when he became famous, he was invited to the United States to give a lecture tour. And so they arranged a car and a driver to take him from university to university, where he gave the same talk on relativity theory. And the driver who drove him there would be sitting in the back listening to the lecture. And after about 10 or 12 lectures, the driver said, "I know your lecture so well, I've listened to it 12 or 13 times, I could probably give it myself." And Albert said, "Yeah, that's a good idea, let's give that a try." Because no one knew exactly what Albert Einstein looked like in those days. So the driver came up, pretending to be Albert Einstein, while Albert sat in the back pretending to be the driver. And he gave a talk, And everybody at the end stood up and gave him a standing ovation. Brilliant. He didn't understand anything of what he's being taught. He's just repeating what he'd heard about 12 times. And I'm sure that many of you could, Gerald could do that. Once there were two bad bricks, open the door of your heart. You've done that many times. Put a brown robe on Gerald, and who knows, he may think that, wow, Ajahn Brahm can speak Cantonese now, amazing. He knows all the stories. But at this one talk where the driver gave the talk, one of the professors was a bit dubious. He thought, now there's something going on here. So when question time, he asked this really deep, profound question. And the driver had to answer it. And the driver said, that is such a simple question. Even my driver in the back could answer that. So Albert stood up and gave the answer. Great little story. But now, to answer your question about stream winning, I think even Gerald could answer that question. Gerald answered. Now, it's important that sometimes we look so far ahead that we don't really understand what we're doing. So the first thing to do with stream winning, once returning, non-returning, being enlightened, first of all, understanding what is trying to become enlightened. The path, which is a wonderful thing about the path of Buddhism, it is a path of happiness upon happiness upon happiness upon happiness. If you want to check me out, that's the Samanyapala Sutta, number 2 of the Digha Nikaya. All about the different types of happiness, where the Buddha said, this is Buddhism, okay, so but you ask the Buddhist question. If you're just keeping precepts, it makes you happy. Your average level of happiness goes up. It's one of the things I found as a student. I gave up alcohol when I was at Cambridge. I thought, I'm going to really have to sacrifice. I won't be invited to any parties now. I found I was invited to more parties once I gave up alcohol because they all wanted somebody sober to drive them home afterwards. That was me. And also, you know, why I went to a party, you know, find a nice girl, find a nice corner and have some hanky-panky. I can't really say exactly, I'm a monk. There's certain things I can say, certain things I can't say. But I remembered when I took alcohol, the best part of a party I'd forget. I was not mindful. But once I gave up alcohol, you know, you find a nice girl, sit in a corner, you know, whatever, and because I was mindful, I enjoyed it much more. Even simple things, you know, whether it's kissing, having sex, if you are drunk, you don't remember much. You miss out as a layperson. Why do you want to do that for? So I learned just to enjoy myself. I got much more out of it. So even keeping precepts as a layperson, you have much more happiness, much more joy, much more good health as well. You're not afraid when a policeman comes to your door. Done nothing wrong. Number 2 is that when you meditate more, you get more and more happiness, more and more joy. That was the thing which really blew my mind. How much joy and happiness you could get from meditation. I'm saying this, but it's absolutely true. The happiness I got from meditation as a student was better than having good sex with my girlfriend. And that was, wow, what's going on here? Why has no one told me about this before? It's happiness. And as you develop your wisdom, your insight, you know it's insight, not because it sounds profound to your friends, because it makes you happier and more free. Wisdom releases you from many, many burdens, many, many wrong ideas, which cause you so much difficulty and suffering. So wisdom which teaches you what love is. And once you can love yourself and love others, wow, that's so much happiness. So follow the path of happiness all the way to liberation. What the Buddha said in that sutra and many other places is nirvana is the ultimate happiness. Follow that. Happiness upon happiness upon happiness. Not philosophy, not ideas, but emotions. We can't really argue with emotions. Happiness is real. You can't fake it. ideas, you can fake it and argue. Go from here, not the head. That's my answer. Okay.
Happiness is real. Thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm.